Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi. For your free trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
I hope that our few remaining friends give up on trying to save us. I hope we come up with a fail-safe plot to piss off the dumb few that forgave us. I hope the fences we mended fall down beneath their own weight. And I hope we hang on past the last exit. I hope it's already too late.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I, of course, am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today to talk about Logan, we have Michael Snydell.
Good morning.
Good morning. We also have Bill Graham.
What's going on, bub?
God damn it.
New catchphrase from Bill, apparently.
Well, he's just co-opting the Wolverine catchphrase from the TV show, maybe the comics. I don't honestly know. So, today we are here to talk about Logan, the newest film in the X-Men universe, I guess. I don't know if you can call it a franchise, given how far detached this one is. This is from James Mangold, the director of the 310 to Yuma remake, and the previous Wolverine standalone film, The Wolverine. And I just found out that it had screenplay writing by Scott Frank, so I'm super excited to talk about this even more now, because I see a lot of themes.
Yep.
Before we get into that, let's just do the usual housekeeping stuff. We're going to be charging pretty quickly into the review, and we're going to be charging pretty quickly into the spoiler section. So hopefully everyone who's listening has already seen the movie. You can follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can follow us on Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. Find us on iTunes, give us a comment, give us a rating, let us know how we're doing. And of course, you can email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. And, as every week, we are brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema, where every day their curators select a new film for your watching enjoyment. Their films are pretty great. They are not your average Netflix / Amazon fodder. They are foreign, they are independent, they are old, they are new and strange, and they're all around great. And again, because they have curators, you always know that you're getting something that has been thoughtfully chosen and selected just for Mubi. So, every day they introduce a new film, and you have 30 days to watch. So there's a 30-day rotating... Why do I want to say platter so much? There's a 30-day...
Go for it!
Yeah, they serve up 30 hot steaming films on a platter.
Rotation.
And you have 30 days to watch each one. So every day, one disappears, but it is then replaced by an equally wonderful movie. And because we love you so much, and we love Mubi, and want you to love each other, you get 30 days free on us to try out Mubi for yourself. All you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage for your 30-day free trial. And you can watch these on your iPhone, on your Android device, and, of course, they now are also available on Roku. And, of course, best of all, something I haven't mentioned in a while, you can download these films directly to your device so you can watch them on the go. So, Mubi, new year, still no tagline. Guys, how are we doing?
Woo! Doing good.
Good.
We were supposed to have a roundtable this past week, but between not being able to come up with topics, because apparently if you don't watch the Oscars, you're not allowed to talk about the Oscars, and a lot of time issues, we were not able to put it out. So, general thoughts on the Oscars. They happened. That last thing was crazy, right? And Jimmy Kimmel was not great.
I thought he was okay.
All right. See, we could
I thought
have
he was
whole...
bad. I thought the Oscars were good.
Could have had a whole episode just talking about Jimmy Kimmel. Let's cut through the bullshit and let's get straight into our feature review. That is this week, like I said, Logan, the latest standalone Wolverine film taking place in the X-Men universe, this time directed by James Mangold and starring Hugh Jackman. Here is the trailer.
Logan, what did you do?
Charles, the world is not the same as it was. Mutants. They're gone now.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
Where is she?
Beneath the stain.
She's like you.
Of time.
Very much like you.
The feelings disappear.
She needs our help.
So that you is the trailer for Logan. So let's talk about it. Bill Graham, you said that you had a thing that you wanted to read first.
Yes.
What is it?
Just a little perspective. Hugh Jackman has played his gig through four U.S. presidents or presidential terms, two Daredevils, three Spider-Man, two James Bonds, two Superman, two Batman, three Hulks, two Jokers, two Lex Luthors, three Punishers, and more.
Dear Lord.
Let's see. He's played the part in nine movies, three different trilogies, in technically three different decades. Because X-Men actually was shot in 1999 and then came out in the summer 2000.
That is bananas. I read somewhere that the space between the first X-Men film and Logan is actually greater than the space between The Return of the Jedi and The Phantom Menace.
That's mind-boggling.
Yeah. pretty weird.
As everybody knows, that's kind of familiar with how Jackman got the role, but it does serve to just be reiterated that he was cast literally last second, 3 weeks into filming the first X-Men film. That's how late they made casting decisions on who would ultimately become the biggest mainstay and the biggest franchise kind of person that they were going to circle around for the rest of these films and all of these continuations and everything like that. I think we got, what, three different Wolverine spinoff films, solo films at this point.
Yep.
That's insane that now, they cast him in the last second.
What was his name?
Doug Ray Scott.
Yeah, he was the bad guy in Mission Impossible 2.
Yep, and it ran over. And so due to commitment issues, he had to drop out of the role. And yeah, Hugh Jackman came in and
he is furious.
Guys, I would defend that villain role in Mission Impossible 2.
No, dude,
he makes it so melodramatic and emotional.
Do not get me wrong. I love Mission Impossible 2 more than I love most things in my life. But I mean,
one of my favorite movies as a kid.
Would you trade that one role for what the amount of shit that Bill said's worth of time playing the Wolverine? No, you would not. So let's cultural impact and world shifting paradigm of the amount of time he's done this aside.
Sure.
Let's talk about the movie. Yep. So, Michael Snydell.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on Logan? I guess, do we need like a summary of this movie? Should I just like rattle something off real quick? It's 2029.
All the mutants
are gone. And the last few are kind of like huddled in the Mexican desert. And Logan, a.k.a. the Wolverine, is acting as a high-class Uber driver when a woman comes to him with a little girl saying she needs help. There you go.
I do want to mention real quick, what I was reading off of was a friend, his post on Facebook, Todd Pult. So right. There you go.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So what I would say first off is that like I've seen a lot of superhero movies, but I would call myself a superhero movie agnostic. There's none I really, really liked, but I've enjoyed myself in in some of them, and some of them I didn't like. But I mentioned that because as a lot of the conversation has come around this, is it's vaguely condescending, but there's a number of people I see who are like, this isn't a good superhero movie, this is just a good movie. And I was kind of dubious of when people were saying that. But I think that I see this less as like a revelation than what superhero movies should have always been, in the sense of this is dealing with a lot of themes that have been discussed, you know, in everything from Marvel movies to the original Spider-Man to Batman, about the balance of an everyday life, about a desire for something away from your innate power. Like, it's dealing with all of those themes, but it doesn't feel nominally about them. Like, it feels very lived in. There's a desperation and a longing to all of these moments, and that comes through in both the storytelling, it comes through in the dialogue, and it comes across cinematically, which this is really a gorgeously shot film. I don't have the cinematographer up, unfortunately.
I will look for it if you continue to speak while I do that.
Yeah, sure. But I guess what I just say about this film is it feels very substantial in a way that subverts normal superhero movies. Like, it doesn't feel like you look to a poster child of superhero bloat, like Amazing Spider-Man 2, which has, you know, like four different villains and, you know, like three different love interests, and you know, like, there's just a constant sense that they needed to pack the screen because they were worried, because there's just such a fundamental thinness to it. And the thing about Logan is just that it's a road movie. Like, this is not your average superhero movie in every sense of the word. And I think it feels all the stronger because from the beginning, it feels built around these characters and their abilities, rather than wanting to follow fan service or wanting to, you know, follow this template. Like, it's just a reminder of, you know, origin stories offer an automatic backbone, but there's no risks, there's no stakes. And there's something about watching characters being put in a scenario where they actually have to live day to day that's really thrilling. I'm not sure if I think this is necessarily a great movie like some other people. I have a few problems we'll talk about after spoilers. But this is by far the most interesting superhero movie I've seen in at least a decade.
And the cinematographer is John Matheson.
Mm-hmm.
And he has done Gladiator, Hannibal, Matchstick Men, Kingdom of Heaven, Robin Hood, X-Men First Class, and 47 Ronin, and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Pan. And he will next be seen in, well, not seen in, but his work will be seen in King Arthur, Legend of the Sword.
Oh, Jesus. That
okay, well, what I'd say briefly about it, since you looked it up, is I think John Matheson's cinematography here is not to compare it to other Marvel movies, but there's a very distinctive quality that I think Mangold and Matheson bring to this. They bring a character to Mexico. They bring a character to these environments, and they make the most of them. And Mangold's a filmmaker I've liked for a long time, and it's just clear that this is someone's vision rather than a product. And that doesn't mean there's not compromise, but there's a soul to this.
I would love to spend an entire episode just talking about how great James Mangold is.
Me too. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I don't feel like we give the man enough props. Like, he's got some great, great stuff under his belt, and I feel like every movie he really brings it. He really goes for broke. But before we get to my thoughts.
Wait, I'm sorry, one more thing. Also, Marco Beltrami's score is really, really interesting in this.
I'm not going to have anything left to say after you, Michael.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry.
That's cool. I'll just say ditto, and then we can get to spoilers faster. Bill Graham, what about yourself? What are your spoiler-free thoughts on Logan?
I think this is a really, really enjoyable film. I think it is extremely well acted. The small child that they got to play X-23 is fantastic.
And her name is Daphne Keene.
Daphne Keene. She is fantastic. This film, for me, I've always been a big superhero fan. I remember watching specifically in theaters the first X-Men movie and just being blown away at that time. The film doesn't hold up nearly as well, 17 years later, but it's still a lot of fun to watch. And this film is just a really, really fitting into Jackman being the Wolverine. And I don't think that's a spoiler because he's already been very outspoken about the fact that this is more than likely the last film that we're going to see him play Wolverine. This is one of those storylines, Old Man Logan, that Jackman and a lot of other people have kind of circled around. And I think Michael is right. This is, in a different way, Michael is right, because this is what a lot of these superhero films should have been, in that they should be singularly focused on a character. They should be focused on the end results of these kind of storylines, and they should be medium-sized budgets to small budgets. They should be $97 million reported, somewhere around there, maybe even less. I would like to see 70 somewhere in there. So you can take a risk, you can make it a rated R film, and you can have fun with these characters and tell a complete story without a bunch of studio interference, and use the branding as branding and take a risk because, you know, people are just going to show up to watch. Logan has been one of those enduring characters. He's been by far, you know, one of the most popular X-Men for decades, and they're using it to their benefit this time around. And so I do want to mention this. The film, from a lot of people, has been claimed to be ultra violent and things of this nature. While I think it is violent, I think what we're seeing is people finally realizing how brutal kind of the claws that Wolverine have are. But I don't think this film is all that violent. I think it's more of what we don't see. There's a lot of flash cuts and things like that. There's a lot of quick cuts, not necessarily from just Wolverine's claws, but everybody that dies in this film seems to die pretty rapidly. And they don't focus on the gore. The few times that we actually see some gore are actually from Logan himself on his body and things like that, because he has not to go into the film too much, but he is not regenerating the way that he used to when he was the cage fighter when we first meet him in the first X-Men film. So all that being said, I really enjoyed this film. It's a fitting end to one of my favorite screen presences. So, yep.
Yeah. So, when this trailer first came out, I remember saying something like, "Well, that's a shot to the top of my like most anticipated of 2017 list."
Damn you, Johnny Cash.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
But it wasn't just that; it was the general tone of. So, for anyone who remembers, when the Dark Knight Rises games came out, I said something like, I want this to be the Melancholia of superhero films. And I didn't get that, which is unfortunate. I still like the Dark Knight Rises. But when this movie came out, I was like, okay, all I need for this is to be the weary, like, picaresque Western of superhero films. And it did it. So, good. Goods as advertised. And that sense of sadness and things coming to an end for a specific character really saturates this film. And Bill, to your point about the violence, First, let me say, yeah, it would be great if we had more superhero films that were willing to operate outside of their PG-13 genre trappings. It was kind of funny that before Logan, I saw a trailer for the new Guardians of the Galaxy film and just thought, like, man, anyone who enjoys Logan is going to hate that Guardians of the Galaxy film. Like, it's just more of the same that worked the first time, and it just didn't seem like fresh or new anymore. It seemed like, all right, well, band is playing their hits. Whereas this is like the band fired their producer and did a really heartfelt acoustic set. And
this is Unplugged.
This is X-Men Unplugged. Wolverine, or Logan, I should say. So as I'm sitting there watching this, at a certain point, I just thought, like, how dare they not make these films R-rated from the beginning? Like, how dare they spend 8 or 9 movies with this character who, like, has this aversion to violence but is very quick to violence, and, like, not show us what he does to people? Like, it's weird to say. Like, he is literally a weapon. He was created in the Weapon X program, and... like, not being able to see the full brunt of the trauma that he can inflict on people is actually a detriment to the character. So,
yeah.
All these times when he's like, oh, I hurt people, but all you ever see is him, like, punching someone and sort of sticking to them. Sure. It's not nearly as intense as in this movie where you see his claws rip through people. And
yep.
It's not overly gory. We're not talking Quentin Tarantino here, but there's enough of it that it just becomes like, oh right, he's not like a sniper or even a John Wick character where 95% of his kills are fairly clean. Like, he's up front with these people. He is usually looking them in the eyes as he guts them. That wears on a person. It's not great. And then to have that same level of violence applied to this little girl, Daphne Keene, who you can't say enough good things about her and her performance. It's shocking. And it's shocking in the way that the movie needs it to be shocking. It's not, and I liked the first Kick-Ass, but it's not just for fun that this little girl is doing these things. Like, you're supposed to have a certain amount of horror with the readiness and the bloodiness and the acumen of her violence. And
it's
her,
not saying fuck and giggling about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's I will say, however, that if you have been waiting for 17 years for Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman to say fuck at each other a lot in these characters, you have come to the right place.
Yes, indeed.
I guess, so that's my weird 5-minute rhapsody on just the implementation of violence in this movie. Like, the fights in this movie, which are entirely mano a mano, have more depth and impact and create more visceral, character-based worry in me than anything that any of the Marvel films have done.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, it just, it's funny. The only good X-Men films are the ones that aren't directed by Bryan Singer.
Yep. Well, like, it's. I think the second one is still pretty good.
But, yeah, I quite like the second one as well.
But beyond that,
the first one is just,
yeah, he needs to let go
ish for what it was. But like, the ones that really do something, and I feel like the X-Men films are the only films that are really attempting to play with the superhero genre at all. And I don't even really believe that superhero films are a genre, but I feel like they're trying to be. And the only ones that really play with
at this point, there definitely are. They are the new Western and things like that, where there's going to be some good ones, there's going to be some bad ones.
But they don't. The problem is that, like, the Western genre has certain themes that they come back to a lot. The horror genre, the noir genre. But, like, the superhero genre is, it's the perfect 21st century genre in that it has no themes or personality. It's just, well, superhero people, massive destruction, and maybe we'll say something about family, which is also applicable to the Fast and Furious movies. So it's just, I like the fact that, like, this is a film with superheroes in it, and it is a Western. And the Wolverine was a kind of, a neo-noir with superheroes in it. And I just, like, X-Men First Class was, yeah, I don't even know what that was, but it was great. And it's just weird.
Yeah,
that, like,
it was a lot of fun.
We keep giving Bryan Singer this thing, and he has, since coming back, created Days of Future Past, which was a mess. And then he created X-Men Apocalypse, and I had trouble sleeping last night, and I was like, wait, was Hugh Jackman in X-Men Apocalypse? Like, I can't remember what happened in that movie. That movie was last year, guys. Yep. that movie was not long ago.
All I heard was about the Holocaust scene, and I was like, nah, I'm good.
Oh, it's so much worse than you can imagine. I suggest getting drunk and watching it. So, yeah, this movie is wonderful. I think it's weird to say that it's not just a good superhero movie, it's a good movie, because I judge every movie as a movie. I won't say that The Descent is a good horror film. I will say that it is a good film, and it horrified me. And this is a good film. This, you know, feels of a piece with 310 to Yuma, which, again, is not just a good Western. It's a good movie. As all, you can't, I don't think you can be a good X if you're not a good movie. I don't know if I'm the only person who tries not to ghettoize things in my brain in that way. But yeah, this is a good film. No qualifiers needed whatsoever if you need them. And I will, before we get into spoilers, just give a final shout out to Richard E. Grant, who plays a doctor in this movie, and he is just wonderful. Has anyone here seen With Nell and I?
No, I have not.
No.
But I've seen him before.
You have, first of all, you have to see With Nell and I, and then you have to remember that the doctor bad guy in this is With Nell. It's amazing. So that's that for me. I know him
from Doctor Who, actually.
Well, go fuck yourself. All right, let's so we're all fans of this movie, and we all think you should go see it. It is out in theaters now, and we can now get into spoilers, so we can talk about themes and ideas and basic plot elements. So, if you haven't seen the movie yet, get out. If you have, let's roll into spoilers. So he dies at the end. I couldn't think of, like, how to begin the spoiler thing, so I figured we'd just dive right in.
Sure. And actually dies. No carry moment after the credits.
God, thank you. Like, you know,
we should have mentioned that, yeah. That there isn't a post credits thing.
I think that it's been made fairly clear that there was no post credits thing.
I was told by somebody else to stay after the credits, and then I stayed after the credits, and then I was like, what the fuck? So, and then I Googled it frantically in the middle of the credits, and that didn't work either. So,
well,
yeah, I still got conflicting information.
No, I knew there was nothing after the credits because James Mangold himself on Twitter said there was nothing after the credits.
Wait, was the Deadpool thing after
that was before
you or before? The same.
That was before.
Yeah.
All right.
Which was,
and that's all that needs to be said about that.
Yeah, that was fine. It's weird that, so, like, here's the thing.
Do we want to set up the film?
I guess, but, like, yeah, all right, so
just run.
She is his clone, Laura, yes. X-23-23. Played by Daphne Keene, is the clone of Hugh Jackman's Logan. And he is given to her, or she is given to him by a Mexican nurse who is taking her from a hospital where these children with mutant abilities are being born and tried to be turned into soldiers, but that didn't work. So they were all going to be put down, but the hospital workers helped them escape and are trying to get them to this place called Eden in North Dakota. And at the same time, we are told that X-24, the next program, has actually created a fairly good weapon. We find out during a particularly harrowing and jaw-dropping scene that X-24 is actually a perfect soulless clone of Logan.
Yep.
A couple years younger, I guess. Or, well, technically like 100 years younger, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, first of all, good surprise. And what a fucking way to introduce that thing.
Yeah, that was pretty terrifying because I was like, oh, he shaved. Wait, why is he doing this right now? I was like, oh my God, this doesn't make any sense. I had
three different starts and stops during that because I thought at first that it was one of Boyd Holbrook's guys.
Uh-huh.
There's a guy who kind of looked like him. And then he puts his fist down and does the claw thing. And I'm like, uh-oh, maybe this is a dream? And then it's not. And then a child is murdered.
Yep.
And I was just like, my jaw didn't literally hit the floor, but I did literally drop my jaw. And I was without words. Because
am I the only one who didn't like the clone storyline then?
I guess.
Yeah, I liked it. I liked it. Yeah.
I just generally hate clones in movies. It's like it's nearly a universal thing. Like I obviously like Laura because Laura is, you know, her own character, but I think that there's thematic resonance obviously to that opening you guys are talking about in terms of, you know, we not realizing what's happening. But I think there's something about a clone that's, it feels so lazy to me, and it just feels so weird because this movie's so inventive. I actually really like Boyd Holbrook in this, who, you know, has been like kind of a scene stealer actually the last couple years and a couple things for me.
I don't know what else he's just been in.
He was surprisingly pretty good in Morgan, which not many people saw.
No. Oh, he was but, in Running All Night.
Yeah, he was in Running All Night as well. That is one of my major knocks towards it. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Which Scott Frank also wrote and directed.
And I got to say, like, it rolls into it. Scott Frank is really good at working within a genre. He did a heist film called The Lookout, and then he did A Walk Among the Tombstones, which is your stereotypical, you know, drunk ex-cop private detective story. And really, like, bringing the themes home to roost in really satisfying ways. And he does that in this. And I think that the whole, to talk about what you were talking about, Michael, the clone, I didn't have a problem with because I'm trying to think of the way to say this. It's not like walking up to him and being like, you're old news, I'm new news, like I'm you and everything better that you used to be. It's a silent, feral, just like homunculus, points to me for using the word homunculus. It's just a force of nature. And instead of like, there's never a point where it's like, he's the bad one, shoot him. Or like, no, I have an X on my forehead. Remember, I said that I would do that, so you know that I'm the... Like, it's just all brutal nature, and it's not...
But it's also a physical manifestation of his demons, like, made into a person, you know, obviously himself.
I don't feel like they lean into it that much, you know?
No, like they don't. Yeah, this is pretty much... It's just it could be anybody. It doesn't necessarily have to be Logan. It's not necessarily... Like, I think what they use it as is that opening scene... when he's introduced, and that's about as far as it really has any kind of resonance. Beyond that, it could be anybody, right? It's is that bait and switch kind of situation that they really play up. And I think I honestly think they could have done without him reappearing. I think the one time we've defeat him, fine. That's fine. That's fun. Let's move on.
I think just the mechanics of who he is, though, makes that a weirdly impossible thing to do.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if he's a Wolverine clone, he should be able to recover from a shotgun blast to the face.
Yeah.
It does bring in this really interesting idea, too, that, like, you know, as, like, SWAT officials, or I can't remember what police, what department it is, but they're walking through, you know, like this transigen, like almost refugee camp where it's just, they're surrounded by mutants and they're talking about them as like these soulless killing machines. And it's like, there's these very interesting, like, systems that they created around this that people are like, oh yeah, no, it's fine that they're doing these experiments, like in terms of police officers are seeing what's happening and stuff.
I get what you're saying about the clone thing. I don't think that it would have, part of me was really worried at first that it was going to be like Famke Janssen as like Jean Grey or something, or that it was going to be Mystique. And I'm just happy that they kept it that small. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm glad that we didn't have another introduction of something. Like, if you're going to make a clone, just make it one of your characters already. Like, don't blow this up anymore. And don't create something new.
Yeah.
I think that in
we have less than five environments in this entire movie, which is incredible.
And nothing good happens at any of them.
Oklahoma City, the new Vegas.
That was
I mean, yeah, that I've been to Oklahoma City and I've been to the area where they kind of are filming. And yeah, that place is interesting because, there's literally two giant casinos kind of across the highway from each other,
Baltimore's
facing each other
too.
Yeah.
And National Harbor has got a casino. We're turning into a nation of gamblers, which is why Fox took a gamble on this movie. So,
hey,
bringing it back. I don't know. Like, I just feel like, yeah, Michael, it makes sense that it would be, because clones, it's right up there with evil twins. You're right. It's a very obvious, easy thing to do. But I feel like it's perfectly simple for this movie, and that in making it as thuddingly obvious, like unnuanced as it is, it gives it a kind of power that allows the movie to have its thematic resonance but not have to bog itself down in any nonsense. And I think that has a very feral, very honest quality to it.
Well, I think you're right though, Brian. What's interesting about it, and this will be the last thing we say about this stupid fucking clone.
I think it's stupid.
I don't either, but that's what we're going with.
Okay.
Anyways, what's interesting about it is the reason I think they go for this character, and you're right, Brian, because if they had introduced a new mutant, they would have had to introduce his powers, his limitations, his blah, 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 blah. You give us a Wolverine clone. We know exactly what he can do. We've watched, 9 other movies where he's in it. We know what Wolverine can do, right? Yeah. And so nothing has to be explained to us. We know he regenerates. We know he has claws that are unbreakable and blah, 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 blah. All right. So it's a really easy way to basically give us another enemy that can fight Wolverine toe-to-toe that is also easily explained. So,
speaking of toe-to-toe, let's talk about Laura's feet claws.
Yes.
That was fun. That's really all I need to say about it. One of the things that's great about this movie, and it's something that I feel like Looper did a lot too, and that most movies that are really good that take place in the near future have in common, is that it uses production design and like offhand comments to fill in backstory more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
To great effect. For instance, Boyd Holbrook, when he first starts talking to Logan before shit goes bad, is talking about how he tracked him down and the fact that a bunch of like gangbangers got cut up. And he said, so the cops figured it either had to be Freddy Krueger or a tiger, but neither of them can drive, one being a fictional animal, or one being a fictional character and the other being extinct. And I was like, oh shit, okay. Tigers are extinct in this universe. That lets me know a lot of things.
And there's
Scott
a
Frank
scene...
knows how to do that knucklehead dialogue so well.
It's so good.
Go ahead.
My groaning was just like in appreciation of Scott Frank.
there's a scene when they're at this what do we want to call them? The family that takes them in briefly before they are brutally murdered.
Characters, I believe their last names are the Munsons.
Okay. Anyways, there's a scene where it's on the nose, but it works. And they're talking about these cornfields and these giant machines that are seen in the background that are monstrously big. And, you know, there's a couple of scenes where the semis have no front cab, and you're like, yeah. Whoa, those are kind of crazy. That's a weird way to drive a semi. And then you realize, oh no, they are driving themselves. And so there's a lot of scenes like that. But I do want to mention, because I'm not sure if we'll remember to mention it, but there is a kind of piggybacking on that. There is a sequence where they talk about how they used all this corn to basically feed the human population to wipe out mutants.
Yeah.
That is
a huge plot point that is glossed over in a great way. Yeah.
Yeah. And it works. And you're just like, holy shit. Because he does mention, what was the family called again?
The Munsons.
The Munsons. On
Will
point,
Munson, played by Eric LaSalle.
You literally mentioned that like a minute and a half ago, and I still couldn't remember it. On point. Way to go, Bill. He mentions that the corn syrup is in like everything, right? It's in to give you a boost. It's in to give you happiness. It's in to give you this, that, the other.
Yeah.
And he says it's pretty much ubiquitous. It's all over the place, which is kind of funny that Hugh Jackman, someone that's living in this timeline, isn't aware of that. But I guess, you know, I still don't understand. Does the Wolverine have to eat? I don't know any of this. I still don't know his kind
of. He certainly drinks.
He certainly drinks.
He gets all his calories from a bottle. I mean,
but yeah, he mentions that. And so that all kind of ties back in, and it's just so smartly wrapped up in this kind of nice little neat package that doesn't have to have all of this. Like, God, I wish someone would just knock Michael Bay upside the head and say, look, this is how simple a plot mechanic can be. It can be throwaway lines.
I wish that Marvel Films, who is under Disney and makes all the MCU movies, would take note, because like this is a movie that literally deals with like the genocide of mutanthood, and I don't know if the food killed mutants or if it just caused the birth of new mutants to be destroyed. Because
what it basically did was it stopped the mutation from happening. It basically made us all kind of so. Well, so I don't think it killed anybody.
Right,
it's just keeping it at bay.
No, I think it's like an inoculation against giving birth to other mutants. And then I think that just in general, mutants have been dying because they've always been hated and knocked down. And also, there is a mention of something that happened in Westchester with Professor X, who has some manner of degenerative brain disease, which causes him to have seizures, which can paralyze like a city block. And he, right before he is horrifically murdered, says something like he finally remembers what he did. And it's something that apparently is horrible enough for him to feel as though he doesn't deserve like this one good day, which just involved sitting down and eating a meal with some people. Mm-hmm. And I got to imagine that like he might have done something too. But what's great is that there's this whole world out there. Obviously, a lot of mutants are dead. Some are still around. We have obviously Logan and Charles and Caliban. But then we also have this like world spanning conspiracy to keep mutants from being born again. And in a Marvel film, like that would become the thing that matters most. And it's like, well, now that we've got this band of children, we should go take out all the corn, I guess. But in this movie, it's like, okay, that's great, but I don't care. I just want this little girl to be okay. And like, like my job now isn't to save the world. It's to save her, and maybe she'll be the one to save the world. It's a beautiful, you know, it's as a treatise on aging, you really can't get any better than that. Like, at a certain point, you have to realize that, like, it's time to step aside. You are falling apart, sometimes literally, and you just gotta, you just gotta make sure that the next one is okay, and then hope that they do better than you. And that's some brutal truth to be dropped in a movie about mutants and people with robot arms. I mean, it's kind of nuts.
Robot arms that aren't, again, as you guys are talking about, so many of these little things just aren't even mentioned. Like, it took me a while, or it didn't, I shouldn't say a while, but it took me multiple times seeing Boyd Holbrook and his gang to realize that all of them are connected by the fact that they all have metal arms.
Yeah.
Like, there's just all of, as you're saying, there's all these little futuristic details that are just in the frame, but just unacknowledged in the same way as these themes and the same way as this world building, which is just there and especially just feels all the more real because of that, because of those performances and because of, I mean, honestly, because Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman like know each other at this point. Yeah. Like, there's no way this movie would be anywhere near as strong if these actors didn't deeply know each other and it was present on screen.
It's also it's deeply weird to me how in a movie like I don't know, what was the name of the last Avengers movie? The Civil War, Captain America Civil War. You could have a character who I spent like three movies with who is the Scarlet Witch, and I know nothing about her and don't care about what happens to her. And in this movie, we've got this guy Caliban, who I don't know if I've ever seen him in another movie before.
You've seen him in X-Men Apocalypse.
then technically,
he's also
seen him at all.
From Portal 2.
Good lord. But anyway,
Steven Merchant.
Talking about the character specifically, Michael.
I'm just...
thank you for the context. Yes, but like, I haven't, you know, Bill. You say he was in Apocalypse. I just gotta believe you. in this movie, like, it takes all of like 3 minutes for me to feel for him and be on his side because of his character, just because of who he is and like the way the movie writes him. And when he gets his comeback, I was like cheering in my seat. I was down for it. And then later on, when his corpse is ordered to be defiled so they can harvest his genes, I was like, motherfucker, like, I hate you so much, Richard E. Grant. And that's just like, that's just good writing. That's just good filmmaking. Like, that's the type of thing that for some reason these movies that have quadruple the amount of time because they're all tying into one another just can't pull off. Because at a certain point, you need to feel like you're anchored in a story that has a beginning, middle, and end. And a lot of these movies, they don't have that. Like, the thing that was going on is over, but the characters remain fundamentally unchanged. They may be in a different place, they may have a different allegiance, but you don't feel their soul having changed. And they never truly feel at Hazard. And in this movie, you know, everyone's at Hazard all the time, and nothing's going well for anyone, which makes its ending that much more triumphant. Its ending, which is technically just like 20 kids walking across the border into Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just, I don't understand why this can't be the norm, why we have to, it sucks that, like, you know, critics are raving, like, this is the best, blah, 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 but, like, why does it have to be only this one? Like, why can't we do this more?
Well, I think the weird thing, this is backhanded away, and I don't want, but I think it kind of gets across my point, is that, you know, even to go back to the Marvel argument, there's been an ongoing discussion, and I think, Bill, you've talked about this really eloquently when we were talking about Doctor Strange, I believe, in terms of how each Marvel movie is an opportunity to obviously, you know, work with this character and then make it whatever genre. You know, like Ant-Man's a heist movie. Like Doctor Strange is your, you know, psychedelic fantasy movie. And there's something that feels less rooted in genre in Logan and more rooted in like a cinema literacy, in a sense that like people aren't comparing this to other Marvel movies. They're comparing it to Unforgiven or, you know, or Shane or
the uncreative people compare it to Shane because the movie compares itself to Shane. It's very,
but what I mean is there is just a texture here that goes beyond branding and goes beyond the usual expectations we have for superhero movies, because it doesn't feel like a superhero movie necessarily at its core. And so that's the thing about this is like, you know, you can get good movies, filmmakers.
Well, just to jump off what you're saying, most superhero movies don't feel like they have a core. Like there's nothing at their heart that they're revolving around. It's, for instance, like when The Dark Knight came out, people continuously referred to it as like Heat.
Sure.
And like it's when you I don't think it's something that people consciously do where like they look at Civil War and decide that it's not going to be called anything like a good movie. People are just going to say, well, it's, you know, it's like it's not as good as The Winter Soldier, or it's sort of like Avengers,
and
like instead you feel it in your bones like this is a movie that is like a certain other movie, and a lot of these things just don't do anything to make you feel that way.
Well, the thing about it I think too is that, like, you know, Joss Whedon, for a better force, whatever you feel about him as a filmmaker, I don't particularly like him as a visual filmmaker. I like him as a writer sometimes, but like he has a vision, but it feels like a vision constantly for the future, not even in the sense of branding, but in the sense of, oh, these characters are going to have a long arc, and I have this opportunity to spend movie and movie and movie. But the thing about Logan is that it knows it needs to get in and out. It knows that it needs to tell the end of the story. It knows specifically what it's going to do. And the thing about Marvel movies is, honestly, I don't doubt by the end that I will have a strong connection with these characters. But again, I'm not sure if it's just the fact that I've spent so many years with them than their character. Like it's an entirely different angle on the same thing. But as you're saying, Brian, like there should be more things where it feels like you're getting a full story and not just the beginning.
I mean, let me take a moment to also beat up on Joss Whedon. I mean, that's a problem with literally everything he does. My wife loves Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I would disagree with you about Buffy, but okay.
My wife loves Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I say, I've heard it's good. And she's like, the only problem is the first season is not good. But you have to get through the entire first season to get a lot of the stuff that goes on in the other seasons. I'm like, well, that is bananas. That, like, if you tell me, like, the pilot is rough, but the second one hits its stride, fine. I'll watch that show.
But like, Bill, where are you on the first season?
I can't remember. I remember watching it, and, and like, I watched
You're
all this stuff
Bill
in middle
memory.
School.
I'm curious.
Yeah, in middle school, like, I love this shit. But I loved it because it built on top of itself, not specifically a season or two. I remember individual episodes and things like that I really enjoyed. But, I mean, honestly, I was a little bit too young to remember this all that vividly anyways. But on that point, Brian, I understand where you're coming from, because before I started getting into Doctor Who, and I've only gotten like I think 2.5 or 3 seasons into Doctor Who, everybody pretty much said was the first Doctor is kind like it all of everything about him. Yeah, Eccleston. Everything about him is either goofy, weird, or not as funny as it should be. And, you know, some people still people still like him. But for the most part, a lot of people are like, yeah, you got to get to Tennant before it really kind of starts to take off. And I'm like, guys, this is not a good way to introduce someone to a show.
Yeah,
this is a terrible way to be like, yeah, you just got to struggle through like the first season and a half. I'm like,
Joss
what?
Whedon,
and he's These episodes are long.
Oh, God, yeah. A British TV show. No, Joss Whedon does the same thing with Dollhouse, which is a show that, like, sure. at its core has become... Basically, Westworld is, like, a better version of Dollhouse. And Dollhouse, like, just...
Disagree.
Took, like, Dollhouse took, like, 9 to 12 episodes to finally, like, do the thing that it decided it wanted to do. And then during the second season, decided, like... we're not going to get a third, probably, so let's just do the next three seasons in one season. To the point that, like, the final episode took place, like, 5 years in the future. It just, like, said screw it. Because you're so obsessed with this arc that you don't think about the fact that you have to make the beginning interesting. And you can't rest on the fact that people are going to trust you. Like...
Okay, I feel like Dollhouse is let's do Firefly at least, because that had a beginning and an ending. You know, Firefly's Dollhouse good. Is something
how
that
many,
had
how
production
How many
shows
issues. Are we going to talk about?
No, I'm sorry. I'm just saying in terms of this metaphor, like, I think Dollhouse is an unfair comparison. I see what you're going for there, but I feel like Logan does not have, you know, like, Logan doesn't have those production issues. Like, Dollhouse is something that was always too lofty. And within the restrictions of network television and what they were able to do, like, they weren't able to achieve it.
Well,
like, it's
this is what I'll say, and this will actually help wrap it back into Logan. Dollhouse begins two seasons too early for the story that it's ultimately interested in telling. Logan,
I would agree.
Logan begins immediately where it should. Logan and someone on Twitter said I wish I could remember who it was, said, you know, it's a shame that they didn't get to make the movie in between The Wolverine and Logan that would have really been like a complete trilogy.
It's
which I only agree with insofar as I want another Wolverine movie from James Mangold, and if Scott Frank could work on the screenplay, that'd be great. But you don't feel like there's anything missing, because even if there had been a movie in between, like, this movie references The Wolverine not at all. And I don't feel like...
One visual reference.
The samurai sword.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is fine, but, like, I didn't need to see The Wolverine to be able to just appreciate what this movie was doing. It's not like...
Sure.
It's not like the, again, the Avengers films where... I remember sitting there in the theater with my fiance at the time, and she turned and was like, is that someone we should know already? And I'm like, no, it's just someone who's very poorly, like, defined. So don't worry about
sure.
it. And, like, that's it would be fun to have a movie in between, but I don't think that it would inform this movie any better. I think that this movie is great as it is. And
guys, we've also spent 17 years with this actor as this character as Bill. Like, I feel like we're giving it a little bit. I don't know. I feel like that context is important.
I don't know. Because here's the thing. Like I said already, I don't like most of the X-Men films. And the Wolverine, like, I will give you the Wolverine. The Wolverine, when he goes to Japan, definitely helps to inform my view of this a little bit. But, like, X-Men and X2 and what's the third one called? X-Men
Last Stand.
Last Stand and fucking Days of Future Past, and I never saw X-Men Origins Wolverine. I heard it was dreadful. But, like,
oh man.
These aren't movies that, like, particularly hold up in my head, and aside from his physicality and his growl, there's not much about Hugh Jackman in those movies that I remember. But I remember him in The Wolverine. I remember him helping to save the Japanese prison guard. I remember him, you know, wandering around in Japan with this woman
and
falling in love.
Do you remember him chopping wood with an axe and looking like he was going to burst out of his skin?
No, I don't, oddly enough.
I remember that scene.
Yeah. But so I remember so much from The Wolverine, but, like, as far as a character is concerned, but, like, you know, the Bryan Singer films never really are never good at, like, setting up an indelible character. I mean, Patrick Stewart gets away with it because he's fucking Patrick Stewart, and Hugh Jackman is fine, but like he doesn't get to stretch his legs as much here. I mean, this isn't. I can't even think of a proper analogy, which is terrifying for me because I only know how to speak in analogies. So, yeah, I don't know, but I don't feel like having suffered through these inferior X-Men films helped me in any way to gain a greater appreciation for this film. That could just be me, though.
I think it's tough to separate. Like Michael is saying, 17 years with this character is a lot, and we've seen him grow, and we've seen and to be honest with you, here's something a little bit more kind of inside baseball. I like Hugh Jackman as a person. Like, he's a delightful pretty much in everything that I've seen him in. I've enjoyed his work. You know, when he's hosting the Oscars, he's a lot of fun. You know, this is a guy that you just kind of root for in all aspects.
I saw him on Broadway. He's a delight.
Yeah. But I mean, and it's just like, and so all of that when,
well,
for
fair,
me,
like,
it all factors
Reeves.
In.
I mean, that's something we know, can do with any actor.
Let Bill finish. I'm kind of curious what he's going to say here.
Well, I'm bolstering what, yeah, I agree with Bill is what I'm saying.
I think all of that just kind of plays into it. It's like if I told you, could you read a book and then watch a movie and enjoy it, or would you have rather experienced it the other way? It's an impossible task. You can't separate it. You just can't.
One
thing either happens or it doesn't. And for this character, I think it's supremely difficult to say what kind of all delves into it, because for me, all of those 17 years that I've grown to appreciate him as an actor in this role specifically, but also outside of this role, as a person, everything like that. All of this, when that final scene happens, it's like all of that kind of builds up. And, you know, I crying for me is one of those things where I can tell when a movie is kind of working well in a certain way, when it's trying to get that out of you. And we've talked about this. We've deep dived into crying into movies. But this movie, it didn't quite strike me in that way. But for me, it was those 17 years that kind of brought on the tears for me. This particular role, this particular film, because I mean, honestly, I've already made my peace with the fact that he was going to die at this point anyways. Like it wasn't a surprise. It wasn't. And that's not to say that films that, you know, telecast or what is it? Well, I don't know.
Telegraph
what they're going to be doing with the character's ultimate, you know, demise. That there isn't films that have got me to cry or got me emotional doing that stuff. But this film, I don't think it operates in that way. I think it is entirely overly somber to the point where it kind of robs the heartbreak at the end of this film for me. But I think the other thing is that it does such a good job of setting up Daphne Keene as X-23 that honestly I'm laying to rest Wolverine, but I'm like, now let's go follow that girl. Like, let's go see what happens to
I'm
her.
I'm the opposite. Jeez. I'm like, let's never make another one of these movies again. Like, and that sucks because I think that they were just talking about casting for whatever god awful new fucking piece of shit X-Men film they're going to make. Well, I did not realize I was that angry about it until just now. Bill, what you were saying and what I was kind of adding to it, I mean, like, you do that with actors no matter what you're doing. It's difficult to, and so I don't want that to rob from what this film accomplishes, because like, if you put Rooney Mara in a movie, you know, I'm going to take in everything that I've ever seen her in, and I'm probably going to like it. I don't think I could ever watch a movie where Tom Hardy plays a villain that I won't root for him, because I goddamn love Tom Hardy.
That's true.
Yeah. It's the type of, and that's just good casting. And I think that that's kind of the genius, the one good thing that we can say about the Singer films is that since they were the first ones, all this indelible casting, Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen, Hugh Jackman.
Sure.
Like, that's where they come from. But I don't think that that's... I don't think that you can say, like, oh, this movie, we're being too cool or we're being too hot on this one movie when we really should be taking in all the context, because there's always context. And half of what makes a movie good is choosing the right person for the role and seeing what they do with it. I feel like this Wolverine is so different from all the other ones we've seen that I don't need all that extra stuff in there. I will say
I was worried in that first scene because it did veer close to what I remembered of original X-Men Wolverine and almost like Deadpool light, you know, where he is being robbed, his car is being robbed. Like, that was like very glib and, you know, like it was much more for violence for comedy. And I will agree with you, Brian, that like after that moment, this is a very different, you know, Wolverine, obviously by design. And I'm going to agree with both of you in the sense that, like Bill, I don't think this is something that can actually be definitively pointed out. And obviously people have different mileage depending on which X-Men they've seen, but there is definitely something about the performance here that is defiantly different, and it is a lot more of a performance and a lot more of like digging into the material.
For instance, my wife has only seen the first and second X-Men films, so I would be interested to see what she takes from this. Because
I think this is a film that you can drag a grandparent to, or you know, someone else with the memory of myself, and just be like, here you go, and they'll be like, oh, this is delightful. Like,
yeah,
Bill
likes it. I have to assume that the previous films are unnecessary.
So you don't need a whole lot of context for the other films, because they set up the powers. They set up that Professor X is this guy that has mind control and Wolverine recovers, but not so well in this film. Because Jesus, the makeup effects on his body are brutal.
Yeah,
they are really good. And I'll say, Michael,
just like craters in his body.
Yeah, he looks like the surface of the moon.
Oof.
What I was going to say, Michael, is you have a point about how it's kind of glib at first, but I don't think the violence is glib. I think actually that's a really effective way to kind of set up the R-rated world of this movie, because like if you remember in the previous X-Men films, he is kind of glib, like says bub, like type of guy. And sure. He puts a cigar out on his own hand because he knows that it'll heal.
Yep, yep.
And in this movie, he kind of has that, and then he gets fucking decked with a shotgun, and he stands up. And then after that point, it's like that jokiness is gone. Like, this is a man who,
yep.
It's honestly like if you were to see the first X-Men film and then see this one, you would be horrified. If you were not prepared for it, it would be a gulf between films as wide and as deep as the gulf between the first and the second half of Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah. Some shit went down.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to try to find out, like by finding someone who has lived in isolation and just showing them Logan and seeing if it's effective without them ever having seen any of the other films. Maybe I'll do that to my daughter and we can talk again in 18 years. but like I said, it's so different. And I don't know. Like, I think that maybe he could use that thought process for creating this character, but I don't know that as an audience, it mattered that much to me at least. What else is there? This movie feels, to use a horrible old-fashioned phrase, chock-a-block with things which we could talk about.
Sure.
Did anyone... This is an easy, fun way to kind of, like, start bringing this to a close. What was your favorite scene?
I think I want to mention this. So this whole film revolves around the idea that Wolverine is kind of not regenerating the way that he is supposed to. There's kind of hints that there may be some adamantium implanted inside of him that I guess his body is trying to recuperate against like constantly. And so that's slowing down his regenerative properties.
Like heavy metal poisoning seems to be what they're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think what's so interesting about this film is, you know, we kind of see hints of it, but it's so interesting because for so many of the X-Men films, we see Wolverine just ripping people to shreds and nobody can really hold him down. And in this film, we see him literally get his shit kicked by a bunch of special forces people.
I will say to anyone who takes the term literally, we do not literally see him get his shit kicked. It's not that kind of R-rated movie.
Yes. No.
An aristocrat's bit.
But like he does get subdued pretty easily by some special forces people without even shooting a gun. Like they don't shoot a weapon. They just really apprehend him, and that's it. And you know, he doesn't have enough force. He doesn't have enough power to kind of resist against it. I think part of it is his fight is a little bit gone as well. But you know, the other part of it is probably because he's drunk all the time. He is not in prime fighting condition at this point.
And he needs reading glasses.
Yes. But that being said, this film gives us the old man Logan, but it also gives us a glimmer of him at his prime because he has this special, you know, green sauce that he injects himself with. And I love the introduction of that because all you hear is just in the background him screaming and you're just like, oh yes. And we finally get that scene in kind of all the rated R glory of him. We get a hint of him at his prime a little bit in this film. So this film is so smart and so clever in that it gives us the old man Logan storyline, but it also gives us the opportunity, because I'm sure Mangold is a film fan as well. You know, why would he be making movies if he wasn't a film fan? But in this way where he's like, hey, I'm making a rated R movie with the Wolverine. How much would it suck if I didn't give y'all the glimpses of Wolverine that he's had in all the other films where he just tears people apart and there's never any blood and never any gore. Like, here we go. I'm going to give you that moment and it's going to last for 5 minutes, you know, but he gives us both of those things. He gives us the somber old man Logan storyline, but he also shows us Wolverine at his prime a bit, a hint of it. So, all right. I think all of that is my favorite kind of scene, the setup and execution of all that.
Okay. Michael Snydell.
My favorite scenes are surprise, have nothing to do with the superhero movie. It's probably the night at the Munsons.
I was about to say dinner with the Munsons.
Yeah, dinner with the Munsons, and I especially like that the scenes that take place in kind of their hideaway in Mexico, especially in the toppled water tower. I think there's just such a sense of like earthiness in those scenes that you just don't get, and it becomes, you know, a hangout movie where, you know, Patrick Stewart's character is, or Xavier is, you know, just kind of a mumbling and, you know, like lapsing into senility, but then that also has another payoff.
To be reading ad copy for a new Taco Bell thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Jeez, baked right into the show.
It's like he's tuning a radio. He's like tuning a radio right at the beginning. But then they're also swearing at each other. Like, it's just such an interesting, odd couple dynamic that then pays dividends over the course of the film. So, I think those two scenes are what they especially made me think of is I think this movie strikes the best balance between what it means to be ordinary and what it means to be superhero since probably Spider-Man 2. That might be my high water mark, honestly.
I will say the Oklahoma seizure scene, if we should call it that. It is at once like the only good things from the newer X-Men films, which are the scenes where Quicksilver is doing his thing. But also, like I said, it's that character-based thing. You know, Charles is having a seizure, and we don't know how he's going to come out of it, and all these other people are sort of affected by it and struggling against it. And it's just... there's something about, like, how everyone is positioned in that room and how Wolverine and Laura work together to fix it. That is just
What I love about that sequence is it could have been very quick and shown Hugh Jackman going from the outside of the hotel into the hotel room, right? It could have quickly cut through. And instead it gives us that scene where he is literally crawling through the casino lobby, then crawling into the elevator, punching the button, waiting for it to go up, crawling through the hallway.
That elevator ride.
The whole time, that sequence lasts 2.5-3 minutes of him just crawling through the place. And you're just like, oh my God, the commitment to this kind of action set piece, whatever you want to call that, is so thorough.
They establish how, you know, Caliban couldn't breathe during the last seizure. And so you're seeing this happen and you're like, oh my God, if these people are not able to breathe while this is going on. There's three different levels of danger to that scene because all the other people affected are possibly going to die. The cars have already crashed into each other. You've got X-23, Laura, and Charles who are being surrounded by a SWAT team. And then you've got Logan trying to put a stop to everything, to the assault on his friends and his friends' assault upon humanity in general. It's really good. It's a really well executed scene with a lot of stuff going on. I also love the fact that you can see the mercenaries' eyes moving as they kind of see him entering, and you can see their oh shit kind of final eye moments before he just very lackadaisically stabs them to death.
Yeah, no, that scene is the best representation of what you were talking about in terms of violence as well, Brian, in the sense of just there is a tactile nature to when those claws go into people that feels different than almost any. I mean, I think people, I saw a few people sharing, I think it's from the first X-Men where the claws first come out and it looks so goofy.
Yeah,
because it just looks like CG foam fingers coming out of his
and again, coming out of in his the hands. Other movies he would just double punch you in the chest and then pull it out and there's no blood or anything, and so it's he's just got an insta kill punch. It's
the one cool thing about X-Men Origins Wolverine which disgusted me is he has bone claws for a little while. And it is, oh man, I'm just getting goosebumps thinking about it because it's so creepy.
They show those in The Wolverine.
Oh, yes, they do. Okay,
yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, it's really gross. Indeed. All right, so do we have any final thoughts on this before we say goodbye?
Stephen Merchant, woo!
Stephen Merchant. Again, I can't overstate how much affection I had for Caliban, who apparently I have seen once before in this film. He's when he talks about like how they're getting the boat, the Sunseeker, and he's like, you know, operative word, sun. Like, I'm not going to be able to come with you. I'm not just going to live below deck. So I was like, that's really sad. Like, are they just going to leave this poor guy behind? Like,
after
he's helped them out so much, apparently, and he's wandering around. And then when I thought that Boyd Holbrook had killed him, I was pissed at Boyd Holbrook. And instead, he just tortured him with sunlight, and then he fucking blew them up. That might be another favorite scene of mine, is when he fucking
that was
takes
a really
those
well
grenades
done scene.
Out.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, beware the light. And then he's like, oh, shit.
I was talking about when he cuts the tarp. Like, just it's such a quick motion, and
Again, Scott Frank. There's a lot, lot of him in this. There's a lot of James Mangold. I would love to see them do more together.
The one other thing is, I know this is the film stage show, but I have to recommend Priscilla Page at Birth Movie's Death did a huge interview with James Mangold, and it's a really fantastic read if you're interested in the movie, Mangold, anything.
I finally got through the first half of that interview, and yes, it is very, very, very good.
Especially if you're interested in Copland, there's some great stuff in there.
Scott Frank is doing a Netflix TV show, is it?
Yeah, Godless, I believe.
Godless, yes. So I'm looking very much forward to that.
Yeah, sure.
Alright. Alright, well, that's all for today. Our thoughts on Logan, which again, is out in wide release now, so feel free to go check that out. Hopefully you didn't listen to all this without having seen it first, but if you did... Well, now you know what to expect. Anyway, we are brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema. Every day, MUBI's curators select a brand new film for your watching enjoyment, and you have 30 days to watch before it disappears into the ether. So you always have 30 great films to watch at any given time. MUBI lets you download your movies onto your mobile device so you can watch them on the go during your commute or a particularly heinous road trip. And, of course, they now have a beautiful, beautiful Roku app that you can use to watch things directly on your TV without having to worry about mirroring or streaming casting or whatever the hell your branded content phone-to-TV item is. I am particularly furious. I cannot, for the life of me, ever get anything to mirror or streamcast or whatever the goddamn hell it is from my phone to my TV in like just a nice normal working session.
Same.
It is a goddamn nightmare.
It usually works pretty well for me. So,
I have like three different ways to do it. I've got the Roku, I've got a Google thing, I've got the Apple TV, and all of them are just like, haha, mortal, that's never going to work. So thank you, Roku and MUBI, for having an app so that now I can just watch things directly on my beautiful 55-inch LED TV. That's MUBI, MUBI.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. MUBI, new year, no tagline. Gentlemen, next week, what are we talking about next week?
Kong.
Kong. Kong.
Oh, duh, do we have to?
Yes.
Fine.
Yes.
All right. So Kong Skull Island is next week. Can't wait to watch that.
Is Personal Shopper pretty soon too, guys?
I think Raw
it's out right now.
Out soon. We'll have to watch. Oh, some of these. Yeah.
And A Girl with All the Gifts as well is out.
That has been out, or no? That was on DirecTV. And you know what? We're gonna try to work in some more independent stuff because I keep forgetting that summer starts in March now.
Yep. Yeah, I was telling my friends that this is officially the kickoff to the summer movie season.
Yeah,
it's been some interesting stuff this year. I'm impressed.
You got what? Kong Skull Island, then Beauty and the Beast comes pretty soon, and
oh, that's next week, I believe.
Yeah, March 17th. Also, T2 Trainspotting.
Oh yeah,
which
I've heard interesting things about as well. So yeah,
and then Power Rangers. So
yeah,
let's,
I'm looking forward to that.
No.
Okay.
Let's get the fuck out of here. Bill Graham, why don't you tell the fine people where you can be found at home between now and the next time we speak?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter wondering about what happens to those cigars that he steals and never smokes in this movie at CableBFG. And you can also find me writing about movies on the Film Stage and freshfiction.tv.
Oh, man, now I'm wondering about those cigars. I wonder if he just, like, he only smokes them in the car with the windows rolled down because she's there.
His delivery of the line, "not okay," is one of my favorite things in the movie.
My wife and I were watching a TV show or something, and that commercial came on with the girl, like, stealing stuff, and I, like, didn't know what it was. And then she pulls out her claws, and then Hugh Jackman grabs her and just says, "not okay," and then leaves. And it's like, "Logan, coming March 3rd. And my wife and I are both like, "okay, yeah, that seems awesome." Michael Snydell, why don't you tell us where you can be found?
You can find me on at Snydell at Twitter, where I promise that Buffy gets better after the first season. And actually, I wasn't going to mention this because I haven't written it yet, but I'll actually have – we're doing a feature on 2007 movies on the Film Stage right now. And I will actually have a piece on The Lookout, which Brian mentioned earlier, and is written by Scott Frank. So look out for that.
Love that.
Look out for that. Damn it.
good joke. You can find me on Twitter, where I will be talking about TV shows that started great and stayed great first episode, such as The Leftovers and The Americans and Terriers and Luck. That's at Brian J. Roman. You can also find me writing on the Film Stage, and that's about it. I don't need to tell you where else you can find me. Don't find me. I don't like you. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all for this week. Tune in next week when we'll be talking about Kong Skull Island. "I get some? I said you can't get none. Had a chance to run, I pulled out a shotgun. Quick on the draw, I thought I'd be dead. He put the gun to my head and this is what he said. Now my name is MCA, I got a license to kill. I think you know what time it is. That was one of the first albums I ever bought. License to Ill. I think, honestly, the first album I ever bought was the City of Angels soundtrack, because I wanted that song by the Goo Goo Dolls.